Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Capital Punishment and Recusal Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 9, 2016, the Supreme Court decided Williams v. Pennsylvania. Terrence Williams was convicted and sentenced to death for the robbery and murder of Amos Norwood. The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania affirmed Williams' conviction and sentence, and his initial attempts to obtain state post-conviction relief failed. His subsequent petition for federal habeas relief also failed. He again sought post-conviction penalty-related relief in state court, and prevailed in the Court of Common Pleas on a claim of unlawful evidence suppression. On appeal, however, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court reversed the grant of relief and lifted the stay of execution, though a temporary reprieve was later granted by the governor for other reasons. The Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, Ronald Castile, who had joined the opinion reversing the grant of relief to Williams, had also been the district attorney for Philadelphia during Williams' trial, sentencing, and appeal. In that capacity, Castile had authorized his office to seek the death penalty for Williams. Williams had moved to have Chief Justice Castile recuse himself from hearing the appeal of post-conviction relief, but Castile declined to do so. The central question before the U.S. Supreme Court was whether Justice Castile's denial of the recusal motion and his subsequent judicial participation violated the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. By a vote of 5-3, the Supreme Court vacated the decision of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and remanded the case. Justice Kennedy delivered the opinion of the court, which held that under the Due Process Clause, where a judge has had an earlier significant personal involvement as a prosecutor in a critical decision in the defendant's case, the risk of actual bias in the judicial proceeding rises to an unconstitutional level. Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined Justice Kennedy's majority opinion. Chief Justice Roberts filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justice Alito joined. Justice Thomas also filed a dissenting opinion. To discuss the case, we have Cassandra Burke Robinson, who is Professor of Law, Laura B. Chisholm Distinguished Research Scholar, and Director of the Center for Professional Ethics at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Robertson.
In Williams v. Pennsylvania, the Supreme Court extended the constitutionalization of judicial recusal, building from its earlier decision in Caperton v. A.T. Massey Coal Company. There were two major issues raised in Williams, both of which were decided in favor of the petitioner by a 5-3 margin. First, the court, in an opinion authored by Justice Kennedy, held that the defendant's constitutional due process rights were violated when the same district attorney, who had approved the decision to seek the death penalty against him, then went on, years, even decades later, to be elected to the state Supreme Court, and in that capacity ruled against the defendant's claim for post-conviction relief after denying a motion to recuse. Once the court decided that the judge had been constitutionally disqualified, it also had to decide whether reversal was required when the disqualified judge's vote was not dispositive of the case, when in fact the remainder of the court had unanimously ruled against the petitioner as well. On this question, the court again held in favor of the petitioner, concluding that the disqualified judge's participation was structural error that was not amenable to a harmless error analysis. As a result, the court remanded the case back to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. To briefly recap the facts of the case, the proceeding originally started with the prosecution of Terrence Williams. Williams had been sexually abused by a number of men starting at age 13. At the ages of 17 and 18, Williams murdered two of those men. In the first case, the district attorney charged Williams with first-degree murder, but after evidence of the abuse was brought forward at trial, the jury convicted Williams only of third-degree murder. The second case, involving the killing of Amos Norwood, went to trial in 1986. This time, Williams had a new attorney, who he met for the first time only on the night before trial. The new attorney did not present evidence of the abuse, and Williams compounded the problem by claiming at trial that he was not involved in the murder, had never met the man before, and had no idea who he was. The jury found Williams guilty of the murder and, finding no mitigating circumstances, sentenced him to death. In post-conviction proceedings, Williams alleged that his trial counsel provided ineffective assistance by failing to investigate and present mitigating evidence, including evidence of Norwood's abuse of Williams and of other teenage boys. There were several rounds of post-conviction proceedings, but in 2012, decades after the original sentencing, the state court found that the prosecutor's office had withheld evidence of Norwood's sexual abuse of other teenage boys in violation of Brady v. Maryland, and the court therefore vacated Williams' death sentence. After the post-conviction judge stayed Williams' execution, the Commonwealth then filed an emergency application for relief with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, seeking to vacate this ruling. This is where the recusal issues came into play. At the time of Williams' trial for the Norwood killing in 1986, Ronald Castile had recently been elected district attorney. In that role, he reviewed his staff's recommendations about whether to seek the death penalty. He had reviewed the Williams case at that time, making a handwritten note in the file that said, quote, approved to proceed on the death penalty. In the intervening years, Castile ran for judicial office, and by 2012, he was serving as Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Given Castile's earlier participation in the case against William, William's attorney filed a recusal motion. However, because of the amount of time that had passed and the fact that Castile had not served as trial attorney or otherwise taken a large role in the case, Chief Justice Castile denied the motion. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court then unanimously ordered the lower court's ruling to be vacated, thus reinstating the death sentence. 2 weeks later, Justice Castile retired from the court. After his retirement, the remaining members of the court voted to deny rehearing in the case. The Supreme Court held that Chief Justice Castile's participation in the case violated the constitutional guarantee of due process. It cited to the court's earlier 2009 opinion in Caperton, where the court had held that constitutional due process required judicial recusal when the objective circumstance of a case suggested a probability of actual bias, and held that in that case that a disproportionately large campaign contribution could create such a circumstance. Caperton had applied an objective approach requiring recusal when, quote, under a realistic appraisal of psychological tendencies and human weakness, the interest poses such a risk of actual bias or prejudgment that the practice must be forbidden if the guarantee of due process is to be adequately implemented. In Williams, the court extended this holding. It quoted the aphorism that no man can be a judge in his own case and determined that Castile's prior involvement as district attorney gives rise to a, quote, serious question as to whether the judge, even with the most diligent effort, could set aside any personal interest in the outcome. It therefore held that where a judge has had an earlier significant personal involvement as a prosecutor in a critical decision in the defendant's case, the risk of actual bias in the judicial proceeding rises to an unconstitutional level. The court greatly expanded Caperton's emphasis in the realistic appraisal of psychological tendencies, and the court emphasized the potential especially for unconscious bias in the Williams case. The court noted that this was a case where the ethics and conduct of the staff in the prosecutor's office was heavily criticized, and where, in the court's view, that criticism could reasonably be interpreted as a criticism of the leadership and supervision of District Attorney Castile. The court strongly emphasized in multiple places in the opinion that this bias would likely operate at an entirely unconscious level. It talked about how even with the most diligent effort, it could be hard for the judge to put aside this bias. It mentioned that there might be incentive, whether consciously or unconsciously, to avoid the appearance of having erred. And the court raised the possibility that the judge would be influenced by an improper, if inadvertent, motive to validate the result obtained through the adversary process. The court's opinion was also somewhat critical of the Commonwealth's argument that Chief Justice Castile's act in approving the decision to seek the death penalty was merely an administrative act. The opinion quoted the Commonwealth brief's claim that Castile's involvement in the case was limited to, quote, the time it takes to read a 1.5-page memo and to approve it. It then stated that the court will not assume that then District Attorney Castile treated so major a decision as a perfunctory task requiring little time, judgment, or reflection on his part. The opinion then went on to note that Castile, as a judicial candidate running for election, had been widely quoted as saying, I sent 45 people to death row as District Attorney of Philadelphia, thus indicating, the court says, that in his own view, Castile played a meaningful role in these sentencing decisions. The court's opinion spent less time and far fewer pages on the decision to remand the case, even though Chief Justice Castile's vote was not dispositive. The court held that his failure to recuse was a structural error that was not amenable to harmless error review. It pointed to the confidentiality of court deliberations and explained that it would be impossible to know and improper to even inquire as to whether Castile's view had in fact influenced the other judges' votes in the case. The court acknowledged that the remaining justices may indeed still be influenced by their colleagues' views, but that, quote, an inability to guarantee complete relief for a constitutional violation does not justify withholding relief altogether. Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Justice Alito, wrote a dissenting opinion arguing that due process does not require recusal when the petition does not allege that the judge had any previous knowledge of the contested facts at issue in the habeas petition or that he had previously made any decision on the questions raised by that petition. The biggest disagreement between this dissent and the majority seems to be one of psychology more than law. Do we believe that there's a high risk of bias on the facts as stated? Chief Justice Roberts said that the objective risk of bias was small, given Castile's limited involvement, as well as the very different questions at issue in the original decision to seek the death penalty as compared to the issues raised in the later post-conviction proceedings. Justice Thomas also wrote a dissenting opinion. He pointed out that the due process requirements of criminal proceedings are, and should be, different than those required by later habeas proceedings, which he notes is a form of civil action. Justice Thomas delved into the history of judicial recusals and to the very limited historical grounds for disqualifying judges. He argued in favor of greater deference to the relevant rules and legislative enactments. He also pointed out that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's earlier decision to deny rehearing in the case, a decision that was made after Chief Justice Castile had retired from the court, might have cured the alleged due process violation. So where are we left after Williams versus Pennsylvania? I think that Justice Breyer's question at oral argument still remains at the forefront. He noted that he was concerned that any rule adopted by the court to address the fact of this particular case could create a potential flood of recusal issues in cases where judges have prior governmental experience. This possibility seems very real. There are obviously very few cases where a former district attorney later rules on the habeas petition of someone he or she has prosecuted. But the court's adoption of a broad standard for possible bias, and in particular its emphasis on the psychological bases of unconscious bias, certainly opened the door to future claims. It's not clear to me how far the court might take those claims, but I would certainly expect parties to raise them in future cases. In particular, this opens the door to bringing forth a great deal of social science research, including research on other types of implicit and unconscious biases. Some level of bias is inherent in being human. No one, including judges, is totally free of unconscious bias. In general, the justice is set up very well to handle decision-making by human beings. Multi-member panels and multiple levels of appellate review can mitigate and reduce the harm of individual biases. Likewise, judicial selection and even judicial election, for all the criticism that both processes have faced, generally do result in a high level of judicial quality. Complaints about a lack of neutrality on the bench, while they exist, are typically few and far between. If, after the Williams decision, litigants routinely challenge judicial biases, then I think we risk eroding trust in the judiciary as a whole.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.